You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
It is the last Friday show of the year, but what a Friday show it is. Heat and Stuart Barber, we're not messing about. We've got Andy Middleton and Bradley Hayden on the blower with John. Just to set the tone for this, we are not going to concern ourselves with the famous Manchester United's disappointing draw against Wolves on the 3rd of January. The 3rd of January feels almost impossible to conceive of, but we will start at the end. We will start with the game on the 2nd of January at 4:30. We're joined by Chris Barber, and we're going to get stuck into big time Chelsea versus Liverpool, a number of reasons, but one is it is by some distance the biggest game of the weekend. Chelsea versus Liverpool, Chris. It's been one with a bit of a red circle around it for a while, but the engraving in the red circles just got deeper and deeper and deeper as Manchester City have won relentlessly, and Chelsea and Liverpool, if we're frank about it, just haven't. No. So how's the general vibe about the fact that have the wheels fallen off? I don't think they've fallen off, they're just jammed a bit.
I think there's an MOT needed. It's funny because when you text me to do this show, our last exchange was just before Christmas, and I think the last text was, if the stuff you're doing for the second, pints are going to be needed. The closer we've got to it, it's vodka in it. I don't know, I sort of, this time last year, ish, give or take, when I'm my brain, Lampard basically questioned the mentality of the squad and got absolute pelters for it. And at the time I don't really know. I've never been around a squad to know what mentality you actually need. And then you sort of extend that to this year. And I was thinking on the other day, we've got quite a young squad still. And I was sort of thinking about, if you go back, young players, which I don't think have changed much as football has, I still think the young player introduction and things like that, it kind of still goes back to that sort of class of 92. And if you listen to how young players, and then into the noughties, young players, your Terrys, your Gerrards, they kind of were like sociopaths. Do you know what I mean? They weren't like lads. And I'd sometimes look at the Chelsea young players and think, I'd like to be your friend, like your weird older mate. but then again, I sometimes wonder, also players from Chelsea have been dropped for quite odd reasons, sort of training ground mentality reasons, and you do sometimes then start to think, well, have they actually got it? Where do you have to hit? Do they hate themselves enough to basically be like, in Finding Nemo, when the shark gets that sniff of blood and his eyes go black?
Yeah,
that's Gary Neville, and before that is Mason Mount. In that sense of, I'd like, like I said, if he wants to invite me out, I'll RSVP, whatever, it'd be fine. But because then you watch the Champions League final, is obviously a good one, and they were just one-off games, and one-off games are so different. And looking at this weekend, if this can become a one-off game, I think it could be okay for Chelsea. But I think if we start following the story of this season, and there's a bit of, we talk about Spurs and it off and things being Arsenal, Chelsea are absolutely shite in December. That's what we do. That's kind of a big management movement happens in January quite a lot, and then we make some odd signings or whatever. But it is that the wheels are coming off. I don't know, but there's something there. There's something not happening there. And then you look at the Lukaku stuff. If we move on, this is the weekend, and it's funny because I think I've not met players, I imagine you lot have, within the club's house, but I understand there's a club presence, and I think you often see a player when they're not with their club presence, and it's a different voice almost. And I think it's got, the more you read about this interview, I think it was weeks, maybe even months ago, but then again, you then sort of look at the context of, he's still fairly young, he's speaking in Italian, he's asked the question about, are you glad you left, and so on, and then you get the question of, are you actually happier? So you've said go on, sorry,
no, go on, no, go on.
And the answer's obviously no, because I'm not going to come to, I'm not going to speak to an Italian journalist who's probably buttered me up in emotion, mm-hmm. sort of emotively, and then go, oh no, but I'm chuffed now. Now I'm not really playing, I'm injured and I can't buy a goal. It's better. See, the context of it extends, but then it's what you do next and stuff, isn't it?
I think it does seem like it's a little overblown, the Lukaku thing, as, yeah. as Chris describes it there. But what I would say, Mo, in an interesting way, sort of as an aside, more than anything to do with Chelsea's current situation of that game, is there's a weird Inter Milan thing where players, and this is historic, this goes back, for decades, where players, everyone gets right in to be an Inter Milan when it goes really well, mm-hmm. and everyone hates it when it goes wrong. They're like Everton, but with some actual winning from time to time. You know, everyone very much, the one-line cliche that we love to laugh at, that when Everton touches you, things will never be the same yes. again. There does appear to be an Inter Milan thing around that, where when they win stuff, everyone treats it as this was the best my career ever yeah. was when I won things with Inter Milan.
I think so. And if you look at the two main eras between the 2010 treble years and then this recent title season, both of them come after long periods with nothing, and not just nothing, but their biggest rivals winning stuff.
Yeah.
So it felt bigger. So you had that crescendo at the end. So everybody who was in that Inter squad who won Serie A, they're going to be connected forever in the same way that 2010 squad were. I think the wider part of it here is that the points where he was talking about the system. So it almost sounds like what he was told on arrival was not how it was playing out. And that was frustrating him, because he was looking at it saying, people are seeing that I haven't scored since September, and they're not thinking about all those other things. They're not aware of these other things. And one thing I've always loved and respected about Lukaku is that he's always willing to tell his side, and he's always willing to be real and put his heart on the sleeve, no matter what the consequences sometimes. And yeah, sometimes you feel like that can be a little bit tactical. But obviously, like we said, we didn't really know when it was made or who decided when it was coming out.
It's a bit anti-football, this, but there's an interesting line where the idea that no player is bigger than the club, you'd have to start then going, well, you've signed someone for 100 million, you've taken him away from probably his best time. Do the club have to make it work? Probably, yeah. You can, like I said, it sounds a bit wanky, and I don't like that I've said it, but Lukaku has a thing with Chelsea. He obviously does. There's those pictures of him coming with Anderlecht, the young lad, and X, Y, and Z. But he's still allowed to be pissed off that he's either been lied to, or the players that he's expected to step up and be his Lautaro Martinez or whoever haven't, in Werner and Havertz and whoever else. And it's not really... And he's annoyed, and I don't think he's chuffed with it, but he's also, like you said, he's well within his rights to say it, because individually he's thinking, well, if I've had it before where I've got a big move, it's not worked. I need to look after myself a bit, because I can't just be crap now.
Well, I mean, there is that, but it's a mad context. I mean, you talk about modern football, modern footballers, and this is a very modern football thing, yeah. especially with, and I don't mean any disrespect, and I will couch this in a minute, London clubs or clubs outside of the north, and I will explain that. That is me being disrespectful. I've actually thought about this.
I agree.
The interesting thing is this interview that he did 2.5 weeks ago for Sky Sports Italia. Now, if the other and about 10 already didn't still think those things, there's no way that gets said. There's no way. The player's too powerful. His agent...
Is he? That's what I haven't got the insight to. Can he... He could retract his words almost.
Basically, well, you can do one or two things. Either his agent can go to Sky Sports and go, you air that interview, you will never get a fucking thing off me ever again. Or, and they pull it, or he gets ahead of it and goes, and the papers are briefed the day before. You know the way that... You know the way the game works. You know, I give an interview, get ahead of it. So you go, oh, there's an interview coming out. I said a couple of things, they're out of context.
Or the third option is to say, do you want to come and do the interview again?
Yeah.
Because we'll work it out, but now I feel a bit differently. I'm back playing, I've scored a couple.
Yeah, that's what, there's always an out. But also what's worse than that, if you're given an interview and you've got an agreed date that's released, it seems premeditated. Well, it is premeditated, it is. Just in time for the January transfer window as well. The problem that he's got, and I'd have a look at Liverpool, I think he's striking. He's even going back to West Brom. I remember he absolutely terrorised us a couple of times.
He's terrific.
But you paid, well, Chelsea paid 97.5 million quid for a 28-year-old. With the best one in the world. Inter Milan, I'm going to go, well, yeah. Age of 28, over 12 months, 6 month return, warranty, guarantee, whatever you want. So you wonder what's... You do wonder whether it's an internal power play at Chelsea to get what he wants.
Well, I think that your point, Chris, on the idea of him protecting himself, I think the thing is, up to this point, I think he's always had there's one more move for me. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if this is the first time that sort of isn't the case. He needs to make it work at Chelsea. If it doesn't work this time at Chelsea, he is left with a bit of a funny reputation through his career.
He's duffed at Man United then, hasn't he?
Yeah. He's gone wrong for him. It's his two big chances in English football, effectively. Mm-hmm. And I do wonder whether or not that's what part of what this is.
He could stay three, because that'd be Chelsea twice.
Yeah.
He's flopped at Chelsea twice in that regard. I think Tuchel's an interesting manager. And I think actually he probably kind of promotes this a bit within his dressing room, like have a personality.
He's come out today, hasn't he? He
said along the lines of, he's kind of touched on the stuff with the context of it, and also it's going to be. We spoke behind closed doors. We're sad to see this is not the player that I see around Kopperman, X, Y, and Z. But it seems like he wants a grown up. Good to go back. He kind of wants this grown up dressing room, and I think sometimes the players can't necessarily cope or manage with that sort of open dialect quite so intently. I think it's interesting because it's whether it's how badly this reflects on Lukaku or how badly this reflects on Chelsea. I can't really decide, because I don't like the fact that you get someone in his position who doesn't feel they can speak and doesn't feel like, if they're not being listened to at work, if you think of it as a workplace, if we were given the option to, you know, go to a national, do you know what I mean? I think that you shouldn't be gagged.
He sees himself as a leader, I think. And yeah. I think that the concept of leadership within that Chelsea squad is really interesting to me. I've spoken about it before, because you look at it and you think they've got guys who have won things around. Like, you think about Thiago Silva has won everything everywhere. You think Azpilicueta has won everything. Mm-hmm. But they're not really regulars in the team at the moment. No. And then if you look, obviously their squad all won the Champions League, but you're talking about a league championship. And this is Chelsea. And most of the leaders in that team, other than Lukaku, haven't. So, like, Rudiger hasn't. Mendy hasn't. Obviously, Kante has. But you can't really see Kante being that kind of leader. He's more the silent.
We've got a captain of convenience, which can work well, Jordan Henderson, in the sense of who's the next best, or can actually go a bit like Azpilicueta, where you end up with 500 appearances, we're not offering a new contract. It's sort of, it's a bit, you look at the league, I've said before on here, the League Cup final display between Sarri and Arrizabalaga. Yep. Mm-hmm. My captain's on the pitch, and he basically says I was quite far away, and it's like, well, you know, your legs are surely operational at a minimum. And I do sometimes wonder that in that dressing room of, like, you can't picture it. Who's I mean, Jorginho probably does, and I think Silva probably has done, but Lukaku will come in and be fucking sort it out, you know, pull it up. Like, we move.
The problem you've got with Lukaku, and again, I couch up by thinking he's a brilliant player. You've got players in the Chelsea dressing room who turn around and go, hang on, what have you fucking won?
Yeah.
And we were here last year, and we pulled that out the bag.
Hang on. It's a European Cup over there. Mm-hmm. That's us, that mate.
And you haven't actually yet done. You haven't done it. That second goal against Villa, so the penalty win was what you want. But it's just not. It's an outlier. It's the only time it's happened.
The most challenging thing for me, and this goes back to the contrast I was making between. Not just saying Liverpool, someone Manchester United, even Everton. A player undermines the manager's authority, which is what he's done. Can you imagine a player but it's a reaction to it. Everyone's kind of like, oh, that's the modern game. That happened at Liverpool. And I don't care who it was.
Yep.
If Mohamed Salah come out and absolutely body Jurgen Klopp in the way that Lukaku's done it there, there's only one winner.
Yeah.
There's only ever one winner. And I'd say that maybe not at Man United under Solskjaer, but when Mourinho was still there or whatever. Or Guardiola, another example.
100%.
It just doesn't happen. And you're doing this as well. Lukaku's going home thinking about the team. If that's his intention... He's 28.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The argument, if it's a young player and you're thinking, oh, I can outlast the manager here, can you really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the thing, is when you're talking about paying 100 million for a 28-year-old player, what you don't have is time. You don't have the time for them to settle in. So he's like, no, we need to be this good, and we need to be this good now.
He'd also be happier as part of a front two in general. I think Chelsea's squad, and I also include some of the lads who are out on loan in this, is really interesting at the minute, and where certain players are up to for contracts and stuff like that. Like, there's a lot of following a couple of Chelsea people on Twitter, and they're all very concerned they're going to lose X, X number of centre-backs because we play three at the back. Mm-hmm. And then the flip side of that is, well, you don't have to. Conor Gallagher would be happier to be part of a centre mid-three and a 4-3-3. As and when he comes back, there's all the little bits and pieces around that. But the flip side is, and the manager's talking about his injuries at the minute, Chris, ultimately, in a really weird way, I feel like everyone at Chelsea can play wing back. Tuchel looks to me like he walks around the streets of London, and everywhere he looks he sees wing backs. Some people believe Suggs is the lead singer of Madness, whereas Thomas Tuchel knows he's a wing back in waiting. You know, all he sees is wing backs everywhere he goes.
You know, the man who mistake his wife for a hat.
Yeah.
It's a bit like the man who thought everyone's a wing back.
Yeah, that's what he is. And that's why, I mean, I don't think the wing back injuries, I mean, I suspect everyone at wing back, everyone at Chelsea's forced to do an hour's training every session on how to play wing back. I think Chelsea will be fine for that. But ultimately, there is an injury issue. There is an energy issue. I think the manager seems to think there's an energy issue.
They looked absolutely. I felt what took them into bed against Brighton in about 60 minutes. They just looked fucking absolutely goosed. The wing back thing, I think, if you look at this specific game, it's one of those where it either absolutely shags us or makes you have to reassess the fact that you could be dealing with at some points like a 6-man attack. And someone like Kante in competition. I mean, the nightmare scenario for me is that Kante gets off in 30 minutes with a muscle injury, because he's so integral to what we do. The interesting thing, if like, to go a little bit full circle, if he can harness a one-off mentality with the fact we're going to have Saar and Traliber and Rudiger at the back, I'd like him to maybe start Azpilicueta as a sort of makeshift right back if you're going to have a fun right wing back, which you probably have to. But there's enough there. I mean, it's that interesting. Like, I you know, I'm watching us and we're struggling and we are knackered and we are injured. But then you are looking at the players on the pitch and actually thinking, then you can kid yourself they're shit or they're second choice. But they also could easily be first choice in this exact same team. It's very circumstantial, even the 11 he picks for, not alone now he's left with circumstance, but even in a good day, sometimes you think, well, why has he dropped him in there? But
this is the difference between in September, when everybody who was coming in was contributing and scoring and everyone was talking about Chelsea's amazing depth, and it was almost like it wasn't as necessary. It was almost like an added bonus. But now you're like, we absolutely need you to do that again.
Yeah.
And it's a very different task.
And there's players like Pulisic who aren't doing enough at the minute at all. It's almost like you'd think he's coming back from a long, long, long injury, and we've sort of got the points cushion to kind of get him ready for the second half of the season, because he just looks lost. I feel a bit sorry for him at times, especially when he's trying to play that false nine. Because I'd literally have Ross Barkley doing that. I think he'd probably do a better job than Pulisic, sort of like being that body up there to at least.
Well, it's worth pointing out the bench against Brighton when they all look shattered. I mean, yes, he's got to use two of them. He's got to bring James off and Alonso on. He's got to bring Christensen off and bring Shelobert on. But then the unused lads there. Kante doesn't get on till 67. Saul's on the bench. Barkley's on the bench. CX on the bench. Havertz is on the bench. Yeah. And Saar's on the bench. These are footballers who can now obviously come in and be part of the offering against Liverpool. So that for all the chat about, you know, different forms of crisis here, that's really quite significant depth. And the other major thing, you mentioned Kante, but Kovacic this season has been the absolute business.
Yeah,
so him being back in it for the game against Brighton, and probably this one's a big deal.
I think so. I wouldn't be shocked. I think I said it on earlier, but I've been knowing managers who dogmatically stick to a formation they can't commit to for a specific game. And I would quite like him to change it up and take a four at the back and save one of those centre-backs and maybe just play Rudiger and Chalobah and Azpilicueta and Alonso as a back four, because you can pack that midfield enough. And if you've got players on the bench and you've got Ziyech and you've got stuff that can change it then, whereas I think if you stretch yourself to a five at the back or a sort of extra man in midfield, when you do get an injury, and it's probably a when, not an if, you are then going, right, well, can you do what he can't do anyway? He's already asked, can you be our third choice to fill in for that? And I wonder if he does maybe try and go to up top and simplify and say to Lukaku, listen, go on then, I'll change it for you. Biggest game of the season so far, let's have a pop.
My last question for you, Chris, before we'll bring Liverpool in, speak to get more of Andy and Mo, is, so the thing I know about Liverpool for this one on Sunday is Liverpool will be desperate to win. Liverpool are in this mentality, in this moment, players of a certain age, the best players of a certain age, where you only get so many chances to win a league from this point onwards. Chelsea are a bit funny. There's a lot of players who I think are important to the squad who are beyond a certain age, and there's other players who are, as you said before, significantly younger. Also, Tuchel, the way in which he's speaking, the way in which he is, the recent results, the way the last 15 minutes of games have gone. Like, do Chelsea really want to win on Sunday? Like, are they desperate to win? Or is there a little thing here where Chelsea would possibly, if you said to Tuchel now, you just won't get beat by Liverpool. You won't risk everything and lose a great deal, including possibly a bit of face, to do that, because you know, he doesn't want to have a season where he loses at home to City and to Liverpool. He's got a European thing, title defence on the horizon as well. Mm-hmm. This has been my weird thing watching Chelsea the last 6 weeks, is they've gone from a side that looked to me like there was a desperation to get results to suddenly that appears to have just dissipated.
And that's why I mentioned that Lampard quote, because you do sometimes think, so what is it? Because I wonder, as a fan, maybe if you said to me, blinking, it's February and we're not going to tell you what happened, I probably would blink at this point and just be like, let's just get it back and see where we are. Let's see if City can slip or something can happen, something to change it. But I think from his point of view, they just look exasperated because they look more like they know, like you sort of touched on the bench, they know the pieces are there. It's just making it work. And then you're looking at the individuals and going, you should be working. So I think they'll want to win, but I don't think they'd risk losing to win. Completely fluff it and not.
No. I think Liverpool on Sunday will risk losing to win.
I do too.
You know, the Anfield game, we didn't expect to go up at that point, I don't think. I don't think that was really in the plan. And obviously the red card wasn't. Well, I mean, it would be weird to plan for that, wouldn't it? Reece, do us a favour just before half time. Just punch it off the line. And then you sort of see, and that's, I think the worst scenario for Chelsea almost is if that game plan gets done in the first 20-30 and we get a goal, because then it's a bit like, okay, you can't convince yourself it's 0-0. We can all pretend at Sunday league level you can, but you just don't. And I wonder if they would rather get to half time and just be tight and then see what gaps are there, see what we can do, see who's feeling it, who's not. I think
so for Liverpool, Andy, I think Liverpool will risk everything in order to win. I think it's a very difficult situation to imagine the manager doing a bit of a shaking hand last 20 in this one. Leicester wasn't as bad as its press in hindsight. One of those games where Liverpool deserve to be ahead right up until they fall behind, and then they emphatically do deserve to lose. But there's an hour there of where Liverpool do deserve to go 1-0 up. But there's no more room for this nonsense now. Liverpool have got to go on a winning run. It's got to start at Stamford Bridge.
Yeah, I think if they come off Leicester with the points, I think we're all a bit more bullish going into the Chelsea game. And I'm with you. I thought they were all right in there. Against, like, funny enough, I was actually talking to Mr. Phil when Leicester scored, and went, we'll be all right here. Yeah. It's almost like they're waiting for, you know, we weren't great. We missed the penalty, missed a couple of chances, and it's one that Leicester were going to tire in the last 30. Liverpool will be fine. Don't worry, it's going to be 2 or 3. Sound. And then you get sucker punched. They score a goal out of it. It's a great goal, don't get me wrong. If Liverpool scored the goal, Leicester score, you're going, fucking hell, it's a good goal out. Notwithstanding, the goalkeeper should do better. Anyway. What alarmed me after the last one, and I will go to Chelsea now, was the lack of maturity.
Yeah.
When they go down. Because for the past 2 or 3 seasons, Liverpool, right, just don't get up, dust yourself off. But they look ragged. Mm. Anyway, so, big kick in the bollocks. Had they lost 1-0 going down, it's weird. Had they deservedly lost 1-0, but went down flailing, you're almost feeling better about it.
Yeah.
But you are feeling better about it.
Glorious failure, doesn't it?
Yeah. So, it all depends on whether they've still got a titty lip on going down to London. One thing they have been good at, though, is not having a titty lip. So, I mean, we don't know. We're in this weird period where we don't know who's going to be fit, who's not going to be fit, who's going to have COVID, who's not going to have COVID. So I'm going on the assumption that Liverpool have everyone available who you would assume would be available. And I would say despite what Chris says, I think the first 20 is really important for Liverpool.
Robertson felt like a miss, Mo. In a way, for me, Shimakas' performance was very Jermaine Pennant in the Champions League final, where he got on the ball a lot and looked as though he was influential, but Liverpool constantly needed more. And after the match, there was a lot, like, Jono gave him 7 out of 10 in his ratings, and I was surprised, but I can sort of see why. There was people, when we were doing the tour live, there was people that I was saying, you know, yeah, I thought we really missed Robertson. People saying, I thought Shimakas was one of our best players. He's constantly involved, and he's doing all the right things, but he wasn't going to the next level, and that was what was frustrating.
I think both things are true. I think he was one of our best players, but that's kind of a mark on everybody else.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. I think there were a couple of times where he was showing promise, and then it was just not quite getting there, and you're thinking, one of these is going to come, one of these is going to come. And because he's at the forefront of those, you are thinking, yes, he's trying to make something happen. And that's one thing he does. He's always trying to make things happen. He's always perpetual motion. He's always trying to find things. The problem is, when you're in a game like that, quality is important. And I don't care who you are, how good you are, once you've missed 2 good chances that you know you should score, and then they score, it's in your head. like, it's in all of their heads. And the most, I would say, concerning thing for me that came out of Leicester was it was another edition where the front four all played and didn't work. And I don't know whether that's because of the two behind them or what, but if we're going to use this as a tactic, if we're behind and we need a goal, then we need to find a way for it to work.
And just on that very quickly, for me, if that opportunity presents itself again and Divock Origi's on the bench, I'd rather introduce Divock Origi.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, I think so too. And you get into the situation where you just get towards the end of the game and you just think we have need to have as many footballers who we can think can score in and on the pitch, in and around it. But I think when we look at what Milner and Keita had been doing in that game to that point, and then we think about how they'd been playing previously and how much game time they had or hadn't had, it just seemed like the worst possible platform. If you're going to have four attackers, you need to have your best defensive midfield behind. And we certainly did not.
Liverpool team, do you think, allowing for everything that we think, do you think Keita gets... I mean, I'll ask you about specific players, knowing what we know, where we're up to, and as I say, it can change. The manager might start his press conference as well in a few minutes, but think Keita starts if he's available?
I think the entire lineup is dictated by... I think the entire lineup depends on whether Fabinho, I just shut myself in the head. I hate it when people say Fabinho, whether Fabinho is fit or not. Assuming Fabinho is fit and can play, I'd have no problem with Keita. Because then you suddenly get the best out of him. And then the Robertson thing, I think... you start with Robertson.
You can't, he's suspended. That's what I'm saying. Simicast has to play.
Yeah, of course. Sorry, stupid Andy. Bloody hell. COVID. Simicast. On the Robertson-Simicast thing, I think it's Robertson's innate Scottishness is the difference in so much as that he likes to make sure. Whereas Simicast wants to get it done now. And Simicast will look more flashy in it. But as you say, he looks like he sticks out to be more flashy in the highlights reel. Robertson will always take it to the byline as much as he can and make it as easy for the striker to put it in.
I'm really enjoying Andy's social geography because it's dead accurate in all of it. Your jumpy London boys is true. Your Scottish make sureism. I like it. It's social geography. I'm enjoying it.
Just check social media later when I'm getting pelted from fucking everyone.
Sure. One thing I think about Simicast as well is that I don't think he's as relaxed enough in the team yet. From games I've seen where he's playing alongside Van Dijk in particular and Henderson, they are on him all game. And he gets shouted at a lot. And it's almost like that's how they're trying to...
Is that why he looks permanently fucking chested?
I mean, there are lots of theories as to why that is, but I mean, that's probably the least likely. But I do think it's something where he's more aware of trying to not make a mistake rather than thinking about the other way.
Which two of Firmino, Mane and Jota start?
Can I go from Chelsea? Yeah. I'd be a lot more confident if you started Jota. I think Firmino will have a great time.
I think you'll start Firmino and Jota.
I was going to say.
Yeah, well, I mean, Manny's not had a great time of it of late, but Firmino, I just think he's great. I think he's class, and I think he's so hard to manage.
I think the Azpilicueta thing with Mane is dead interesting in that I feel as though, having watched Azpilicueta and Mane come up against each other for years, I feel as though one wins and one loses.
Yeah.
And it's been different ones at different times, but one wins and one loses. But it ends up being this pitched one-on-one battle.
Yeah.
And I think that's not in Liverpool's interests. I think movement's in Liverpool's interest against this Chelsea team.
Firmino will just have...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think he's great. I love him, Matt.
If we can field five of the front six that played at Old Trafford, Jota, Firmino, Salah, Henderson, Keita, and add Fabinho to that, I'm a very happy man.
I'm not.
Just one final thing on the lineup, Neil. Sorry. I think Salah's going to have the biggest fucking bee in his bonnet ever.
Yeah, so do I.
And I mean, that is a positive, because generally when he's got a cob on with himself, that's when you need to.
He'll also be annoyed. He didn't do his interview with Sky at Lee when he played for Chelsea, wasn't he?
Well, of course. But you know what?
Why are you doing that to me?
you forget these things.
You forget these things. You do.
No, I think Salah will be pissed off because he has not just the penalty, he then misses the header and then he fluffs. Because Henderson's behind him.
Yeah.
And then he just kind of... Normally when we've seen Salah miss penalties, we've seen Salah miss chances, and he just kind of grins it off and goes again. didn't look happy, did
I actually think Salah, of all those brackets general tricky wingers, he's the only one who I think gets better when he's has to, when he's like, fuck this, I'm up. Do you know what I mean? I think a lot of them disappear in that or try too hard. He almost, when he levels up that intensity and dials down the laughs, he's better. He is.
Prediction?
2-2.
I have to say it. I think we're going to win, but it's going to be tight as hell.
2-2, funny enough.
And that's a memory of Desmond as well. I
can't take
it. Oh, Jesus Christ.
Not the joke. Can't take the idea of 2-2. I'd almost rather get beat 3-2. If it's 2-2 with 5 to go and there isn't a winner, I just think people might as well just go and drive the fucking trophy to City.
Oh, no.
Does the City result affect you? In a sense. Sorry, Jan.
Sorry, go on. What?
Does the City result, if they lose... Do you think that will massively affect our both dressing rooms?
No, because I don't think it might affect Chelsea because I don't know if Tuchel entirely understands what he's up against.
Yeah.
I think from Liverpool's point of view, it becomes, they're not going to, if City lost.
We've seen this film before.
They're not going to do that very often, lads. Yeah. You're not going to get many weekends where you get to get 3 points back.
You're
on
almost going
to
like walk down if they lose, like march, don't you, en masse. Mm-hmm. We're going now.
Yeah, no, I think there's a real...
Honestly, if it's 2-2 with 5 to go and you offered me a grand either way on one of them getting the winner and betting again, I'd take it. I'd flip that coin. Whereas I don't think Chelsea would.
And Ron would get a booking for taking his shirt off when he scores it as well.
Well, I wouldn't, if it was 2-2 with 2 minutes to go and this wouldn't happen, but I wouldn't be averse to Liverpool sending the keeper up. If Liverpool sent the keeper up, I'd go, fucking is right. but it won't happen. That won't happen. And it probably shouldn't. Liverpool do need to be more professional than I am. But Liverpool, this is a game, no matter what City do, this is a game Liverpool pretty much have to win. If not, it just becomes exceptional. Hard, not impossible, but exceptionally hard, and it's difficult to look beyond that. On Arsenal versus City, Arsenal have no coaches, but seemingly a lot of players. They have had rest, but there's a problem when you're watching City at the minute. I think City are dead interesting in that. I think that they're obviously brilliant, don't get me wrong, but they're not. They're back to the City that aren't a lot of fun to watch. Mm. And I wonder if he's got a little thing in the winter months where he's almost got a Ferguson thing going. Ferguson had a different thing, I think, obviously back around sort of if you think 07 through to about 2010. But United would be brilliant in that era of grinding out horrible winter wins. City, it doesn't feel like anywhere near as much as of a grind, but the game management's exceptional and it's the greatest trick they're pulling.
It is, and the act of confidence that selling Ferran Torres is in this situation when everybody was talking about them needing another forward, it's like, no, we didn't buy one and actually we're going to sell this fella because we're good. And you know what? They are. And that is also a very, very powerful message. But you're right, they have been trained to peak at this time. And the interesting thing is, if you look back on some of the previous years, they've lost key players at this time and it hasn't really affected them. Now, one thing I would say about the matchup with Arsenal, it's still a very interesting tactical battle between Arteta and Guardiola, because there is always going to be the feeling that one of them wants to get the over on the other one. And I feel like this is always a game where one of them is going to try and outthink the other one to their own detriment. It might be Guardiola. It's more likely to be Arteta, but it really could happen to either of them in this kind of game, I think.
For me, the strange key to getting a result against City, Chris, I think, is finding ways to make the players fulfil traditional roles. So you've got to do both. You need to make the defenders defend and make the attackers attack, rather than effectively letting 10 lads midfield. And that's what I think Arsenal have to have a plan for. I think if you think about the Crystal Palace result, part of how they get it is they make certain City players have to defend. And I think the Southampton 0-0 at home, City players need to attack. And they don't actually do it that well in that game. And I think there's instances where when they've got to fulfil traditional roles, that's when it looks a little bit off. But when they get to do their thing, they do it so well.
I think you're absolutely accurate. The way they're drilled is almost play a different sport, in a sense of the stuff you hear about the number of players in particular channels and X, Y, and Z. Like, if you can just rattle them, and it sounds a bit old school and it sounds a bit Brexit-y, but if you can just get amongst it and turn them into a team with three different types of players, then they have to then react to you. And no, so few teams get City to react to them, sometimes for a 10, 12 minute period. And then like Brentford the other night did it, where clean it off, and then City just go up the other end and just sort of like ruthlessly Foden scores a wonderful little volley. I think there's something that I'm equal measures impressed and shocked at how well City seem to have managed this outbreak, because they've not really been affected. And it's impressive. And I think they've obviously done that through either commitment to the idea of, like you said, that this is our part of the season and that actually, you know, stay in from November, whether that was official or not, because they don't seem that affected. But they don't have any players missing. They don't have many outbreaks. The fact that he can drop Grealish and Foden for basically being bellends in the middle of all this is impressive in itself. But I do think Arsenal are beginning to like purr. And if for example, if Xhaka can just stay on the pitch for a game, because that seems to happen against City so often, or sometimes in the North London derby for them. And I think someone like Saka and Emile Smith Rowe and Lacazette I think they can piss them off. They can piss City off. And I think that'll be really that'll make it a game. However, if City can just, like you said, go, all right, you've had your turn, now we're going to do our thing, then we're just on. It's happening, isn't it? The machine rolls on, because they're see. I think you've nailed it with their like season management is, and also he almost has like a new roll of the dice. Like he kind of pulls in Bernardo Silva this time last year. He like rolled out Gundogan. Like he just seems to have a new thing. You know that Phil Neville quote when he's like, Fergie said, you're not playing, but I need you in 3 weeks. And he's like, I don't know if I've been dropped. I've been told I'm the best player in the world. You can almost imagine Pep saying like, no, you're winter. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You're winter, Kevin. And then Kevin happens at winter.
I think there's definitely an element of that with them. We're going to come back onto Liverpool in a minute or two because Klopp is doing his press conference. We'll let more information come and we'll circle back around. But Andy, on the, you know, for me, on the City point, for instance, is I thought Wolves, until Jimenez gets himself sent off, were doing the thing that City don't like. They would, you know, they barely create a decent chance, City, before half time. Simultaneously, you've got this constant threat that is Traore and Jimenez in different ways. The City's backline didn't like that. There was a couple of bad fouls that had already been thrown in. Can Arsenal do that with the resources they've got? I'm thinking about Saka. I'm thinking about Smith Rowe. I'm thinking about the sort of footballers who've got something in the locker which can pin Manchester City players back. Or do you just think Arsenal? I think Arsenal will just end up in this midfield scrap that suits City and does not suit Arsenal.
I mean, they can, but whether they will is highly unlikely. I suspect they will make the cardinal sin, Arsenal, of doing what City want them to do. And basically, if you want to have any chance against City, don't concede in the first 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. That's it. Once City now,
yeah,
are that good at retaining the ball. You talk about City players and, you know, playing the way they want to play. They do that when they're in. It's a lot easier for them to do that when they're in the ascendancy, because they can just pull you around everywhere. I mean, the amount of times this season City have scored in the first 20, I think it was, they scored in the first 20 against Brentford, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And then it's then a mountain.
It's the most heartbreaking notification you get on your phone when you're not watching them, and it's like 1-0, 2 minutes, 1-0, 4 minutes.
Yeah, but even 1-0, it's like, yeah, there's never any real sense of, unless something mad happens, like a handball or a penalty or whatever. I agree on the Wolves point. Thought it was an engaging contest, which was why it was so fucking infuriating.
Oh, yeah. He's a fucking dope, isn't he? Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
I'm still annoyed with him. Yeah. He's so, a fucking dope.
So talking of dopes, what we say about Granit Xhaka?
Yeah.
Well, this is the thing, exactly. Right? I mean, I personally think Granit Xhaka is absolutely key to everything, because in order for Arsenal to be able to do the good version of what they need to do, he needs to play well, but he also needs to not do something stupid. Mm. So you need to be able to
He needs to forget he's playing Man City. That's what he needs to do.
But then you look behind them, they've got a problem at right back, because all three of their right backs are injured. So they played Ben White at right back against Norwich, and it's like, yes, Norwich. Now, Ben White and Gabriel have been strong in the middle. Do you want to risk losing that, particularly if you've got Xhaka ahead of you? You want to have that secure. So then that means, who's playing right back? Are you playing Rob Holding at right back? Are you swapping over Kieran Tierney and playing Tavares left back?
Does he go to
back?
A three?
Does he go to a three? So, the potential for something funky comes a little bit higher. But I also think they've got a position up front, decision up front as well. Like, talking about what you're saying about not being bogged down in midfield, Lacazette, his best, he comes deep and he links. That's what he's good at as a nine, but this is not what you want in this game. Stick Martinelli up there, have Saka, Smith Rowe, and Odegaard behind them, and really go.
Yeah.
I want Mo to pick this team. I'm with that 100%, but I think Lacazette is important to them. Okay, then. Two things back to back. We'll do them back to back. Watford face Tottenham. So we'll have Bradley Hayden first at the 3 p.m. But at 5:30, Crystal Palace face West Ham United. We have got Andy Middleton talking from the West Ham point of view. Big win for them the other day. So Bradley on Watford, Andy Middleton on West Ham, both with John Gibbons. And then we'll be back. We will chat then about Southampton. Southampton's game, Leeds game, the Brentford game, and we'll circle back, ending it talking about the Liverpool game against Chelsea when Klopp will have finished his press conference, which is very kind of him.
And he's jumping into Bradley Hayden. And Bradley, I can't wake you guys out at all. Maybe it's because I was at Goodison Park and I got caught up with all that. And then obviously we had the United win that we all enjoyed together. And since then, I mean, I can't figure this out at all. Help me out.
Well, I can help you out in a sentence. Our defence is rubbish. And I think that would sum ourselves up, really. People will look on the outside, and I know it's been spoken about since, about, you know, how much of an impact Claudio Ranieri has had. But a lot of Watford fans are behind Claudio Ranieri because we can see what he is doing. He's made us a lot more better to watch. We're attacking a lot better. Mm-hmm. And that's come across with the amount of goals that the likes of Emmanuel Dennis has been scoring. Josh King's been getting involved. Obviously, Ismail Assar's been a miss with his injury, expected to be back at the start of February. But unfortunately, there's only so much Claudio Ranieri can do. And with this defence, I mean, any team can just run rings around us. We've got the worst defensive record in the league, the worst in Europe. You know, I think we've got the Premier League record at the minute for the most games without a clean sheet. So, quite sums it up, I think, to be honest. And it's been a problem area for Watford for some time, to be honest. Lack of investment in defence. I mean, you look at the last central defender that we paid money for, and that was Craig Dawson back in 2019, when he paid something like $4 million for him. Before that, you know, you've got to go back to the likes of Jose Holabas, who was a left back, who he paid something like $1.8 million for. Then you've got Cabaselli, who's our record defensive signing at $6 million. Aside from that, when you compare the amount of investment that we've invested in midfield and up front, we spent heavily on the likes of Ismail Assar and Deulofeu and Doucouré down the years. That sort of investment has never quite been matched in defence. And I think when you look at the Premier League this year, it's taking the best sort of quality that we've seen in some sort of time. Whereas before, you may have been able to get away with being able to outscore teams and being able to rely on the likes of Dennis and King to score, to conjure up a moment of magic, or to stick a couple in the back of the net and to win games 3-2 or 4-2. This year you can't quite do that. And with our defence, we can't rely on our defence to bail us out if we need a helping hand, or if we need them to stand firm. And we're conceding 2 or 3 a game. And you look at the goals that we're conceding, and they're not particularly good goals. I think if we had a half-decent central defender in there helping us out, a bit more experience in defence perhaps, then we wouldn't be conceding the amount of goals that we have been conceding. So it's make or break for Watford, really, in January. If we invest in the defence, bring in a centre-back, a left-back is important as well, with Adam Messina going to the Africa Cup of Nations and Danny Rose not being fully fit. If we can get a centre-back, a left-back, a goalkeeper, I think is important as well. I don't think Dan Backman's covered himself in glory. Ben Foster's out. And maybe a central defensive mid as well. I think those are going to be key areas for Watford to strengthen in, especially defence. If we improve the defence, I have faith that Ranieri can keep us up. But if we don't, then unfortunately I don't think Claudio, despite the miracle that he did with Leicester, I don't think even Claudio Ranieri will have the power to keep us up if we don't invest in our defence.
Are you expecting that to happen then? You know, you've mentioned quite a few areas there we'd like to see them strengthen. What do you think the most likely sort of outcome is? Not necessarily in terms of, you know, specific players, but, you know, in terms of, you know, outlay and numbers.
Well, we have been linked with a fair few defenders in recent weeks. Vida, the former Croatia captain at Besiktas, was one we've been linked with most recently. There's been other names thrown in as well. Issa Diop, Steve Cook from Bournemouth. I think lots of Watford fans have their fingers crossed that we don't touch Steve Cook from Bournemouth with a barge pole. And it seems like that's not going to happen now, thankfully. So it does seem like we are looking in those sorts of areas. We have been linked with a couple of left-backs as well. So it does look like we're gonna invest in that. One or two goalkeepers have been linked as well. Dan Backman sort of said that, you know, if he doesn't get regular game time, he's looked to go in January. So it seems, you know, that we may look to bring in a goalkeeper as well. But we do have one already in the door, but we can't bring him in until next year. Maduka Okoye, who we signed from the Eredivisie, but he's back on loan there until the end of the season. So it does seem like we are going to invest in the defence in January. Shaik Lazanach is another one from Arsenal as well, we've been linked with on a loan until the end of the season. So it does seem we are looking in those sorts of areas. Fingers crossed that we do manage to bring a couple of in what is a pivotal January for Watford, really. Look at the fixtures once we get Spurs out of the way. We've got Newcastle away and Norwich at home in January. Two crunch fixtures. And with the likes of Emmanuel Dennis, Adam Messina, Imran Lusa, and William Troost-Ekong going off to AFCON in January. And with the number of COVID issues Watford have had over the past couple of weeks, it could be a threadbare squad for us in January, and we really do need to have some ideally in the door before we face the likes of Newcastle or Norwich, which are two crunch fixtures for Watford, really. We get a couple of wins or 4 points, and hopefully we can look to build.
You know, you mentioned there about building and players coming in, but obviously, you know, 1st of January against Tottenham, you're going to have what you've sort of got now. You mentioned a leaky defence, you know, with Son back in form, Harry Kane scoring again. You know, it's he's got his head in his hands, audio listeners. It's going to be a tough ask, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's going to be a real tough ask. What we can't do is concede in the opening 10 minutes or 20 minutes, which we seem to have an absolute habit of doing against the big teams. It's important to stay focused, and we need our big players to turn up. Emmanuel Dennis, who has been amazing for us, really. It's a shame that so many of his goals he's not been able to celebrate properly for us. We're going to need him to be in form. I mean, when you consider signings of the season so far, he has to be up there. And he's $3.5 million. He's got 8 goals and 5 assists in a struggling Watford team. You know, you think what he could be doing if he had better players around him. You know, those figures could be even higher. So I expected him to turn up in what will be his last game before the African Cup of Nations. Expecting Moussa Sissoko to perform as well. He's been important for us this season. Looks like one of the only sort of Premier League quality players that we have in that midfield. Expect him to turn up and try and sort of have a point to prove against his former club. But as you say, it's going to be all about the defence and whether we can keep that door shut and whether we can, you know, restrict them to relatively few chances. But that's not been the case. And it seems like when we got the fixtures, when I was looking at the fixtures at the start of December, when we're just starting to get to the end of that really difficult run, I saw the fixtures over Christmas and thought we might have a chance, especially against Spurs at home. But yeah. Now, seeing with the way they're performing under Conte, it seems like it's going to be a really difficult task for us, to be honest.
Oh, we shall see. But you're still smiling, you still got positivity.
I'm trying to.
Top man, thanks for joining Bradley back to the show. And it is John Gibbons with Andy Middleton. And Andy, after a disappointing one, Boxing Day at home to Southampton, it must have been great to bounce back against Watford, and in style as well, went 1-0 down, but then ended up thrashing them.
Yeah, it was nice to bounce back. You get a little bit worried, don't you? You know, we've been on a bit of a run, and then you have an unexpected home defeat where when we got back to 1-1, I think everyone expected us to go on and win it. I certainly did. And then, then poor. So, yeah, it was nice to bounce back with a win. I thought we played quite well. You know, I think we played quite well in a number of our defeats as well, to be fair. So it's not like we've suddenly lost form. Our back four is obviously struggling a bit. But, yeah, nothing's had big alarm bells ringing in my head yet, but it was nice to bounce back with a nice 4-1.
Yeah, they responded well to the goal. I mean, it's a really nice opening goal, to be fair, from Dennis, but then it's all West Ham after that, and then, you know, the goal takes a while to come. I think it's just before the half an hour, but it sort of had been coming in. I guess good to see Suchek getting in the goals as well. Hasn't got quite as many as he did last year, but he took that one well.
Yeah, he did, and I think it's probably one of the... one of the problems, Moyes alluded to it, something they've got to fix. I think the new role of Declan Rice, where everyone's raving about him more and he's rampaging forward and all this good stuff, has definitely affected Souček's ability to do that. And I think Noble coming in and just sitting meant Souček was probably in a role he prefers and a more familiar role, and he's straight on the score sheet. So, yeah, I think it's probably something we've lost for all it's improved. Declan has made him look a more standout player. There's an argument we've lost a little bit from our midfield from Rice not sitting, and because Souček's, I think, a lot more effective in the final third than Rice is at the moment in terms of what he does. So, yeah, it was nice to see him get back on the score sheet. Be interesting to see if Declan comes back in today, though, what they do in terms of those two roles.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting, thinking about that, you know, in terms of the knock-on effects of asking someone to do something sort of slightly different. Is he a possibility for today, that is he Declan Rice?
Well, for today, even, you know.
Yeah, no, you mean the next case.
I mean, it was a one-game suspension, I think, for the five yellow cards. So,
right, okay.
So in theory, he'd be back in. We're a better side when he's in there. But I think it's something Moyes touched on it about a month ago, about the changing role had probably affected Souček more than it had anyone else. I mean, he was 10, 12 goals last season or something. So, and as I said, I think he is extremely effective in that final third when he gets given that license to go forward. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see if Declan sits a little bit more in some of these games and they look. Thomas get forward again. But yeah, nice to see him score, as you say.
The 4-1 score by Vlasic, and his teammates seemed delighted for him, is what I sort of noticed. There's quite a few mentioned afterwards that they were so pleased for him. Obviously, he's been putting the work in, and, you know, seems a popular boy and gets his goal.
Yeah, I think, again, there were some comments from Moyes about, you know, the quality he shows in training and his finishing in training. And seeing for Croatia, there's obviously a real player there. And I think Moyes has done this quite well with players that take a while to fit. You know, he'll bring them in and out and make sure they're right. But I think that was lovely to see. And it probably, again, epitomises the squad feel he's got down there, that the players seem genuinely delighted for each other when people come into the side and do well. So... that was good. And I definitely think there's a player in Vlasic. I think, you know, over the second half of this season, certainly going into next year, we'll start to see that. He looks like he's got some real quality.
Yeah, let's hope so for him as much as anything else. So looking ahead to the weekend's game, it's Palace here, 5:30 on Saturday. Palace, a bit of a tricky one to make out this season, sort of, you know, good and bad from them. You know, at times, you know, games that when I've watched them, they've looked really good. And then others, they've sort of struggled a little bit. Obviously got, you know, didn't have a great result sort of last time out. So what do you make of this sort of going to another bit of a derby, I suppose?
Yeah, sort of.
You have so many in London, you can pick and choose, can't you?
I don't know. I never liked, you know, we've historically got a very poor record against Palace. I think they're up there with Brighton and a bit with Southampton with sides that we've always never done as well again as we should have done. So, I never look forward to playing them, and obviously got the draw at our place earlier in the year. But more for the point you just said, I don't. You're never really sure what's going to turn up. If they play, they've got some players, and could easily turn you over. And yet some games they look a bit lethargic and a bit not at it. So I'm not feeling super confident. I'd happily take a draw now. We don't have a great record on New Year's Day evenings, I think, if you look back on all those nonsense stats of the past. So, I'd happily take a draw now. I think it'll be a tough game. I think going there, if they play us, historically a tough place to go anyway for us. Yeah. So, yeah, I'd take a draw now. But you know, as I said, I'm buoyed by the fact that, you know, some of the losses, the loss against Tottenham, the loss, we've kept playing football and we've kept looking like a good side, even when we've lost those games. So if we go in and do that, then I'm not fearful anything super bad's going to happen, but I would take a draw.
Yeah, sorry, I've got a bit confused. I watched them against, on Boxing Day against Tottenham, they got beat 3-0 and Zaha got sent off, but obviously they've won since then against Norwich, so they got that win. But, you know, have had the two games, one of the two clubs like West Ham, who've managed to get both of their games in over the Christmas period.
Christmas time, yeah.
Yeah, so you're saying you take a draw in this game, and obviously, you know, the the games are weighing heavy on sort of both of you. Where do you think that leads you sort of going into the new year? Say if you sort of got a point in that one. West Ham are currently fifth, although the table's a little bit all over the place, obviously, because teams, you know, all on different games played. Tottenham and United both played two less than you, sort of just behind you. How are you feeling sort of going into the new year about where West Ham are and in terms of what's possible for the rest of the season?
Yeah, you've got to look at our rival. We're finishing the season in fifth. I think that says it all. You would take, you know, with what was predicted probably by the fans, but as well as by the pundits, with the Europa League campaign and the extra games and the inexperience of this, that, and the other. To have got to one cup quarter final, to be in the last 16 Europa League and still be fifth, is an amazing achievement. To be fair. I didn't think, as I've said on air many times, that we've got the squad to sustain a top four challenge. I think having three of our first choice back four out for a while, we're missing Creswell a lot, but both his creativity and his defending, you know, to keep churning out results at the moment while we hopefully reinforce in January and get certainly Creswell and Zouma back in some point, that I'm more than happy with that. I really am. And I think, you know, the job Moyes has done is outstanding. I didn't expect us to be here in the league coming into the end of the year with Europa League and everything laying on us. So I think it's an amazing achievement. And to still keep doing it with, as I said, missing three of our first choice back four and then Antonio or Bowen having to swap as strikers and things like that, I think he's done a great job. So if we stay in touch and get a bit further in Europa League, I think that's been another very, very good season yourself. That's what I'm saying now.
Last year you had a bit of a late Christmas present. Jesse Lingard came and did really well. Might there be something else?
I wouldn't mind the same Christmas present again. I'd take that. I think, you know, we it's one of the problems with these injuries, right? Depending on how Creswell's chipped a bone in his back, and I don't know how long he's going to be. So all of a sudden, then a left back becomes a priority for the window, and we definitely need a centre back. So I don't know how much cash we've got floating around because we've needed a striker since the summer. So I don't know what's going to happen. I'd love to see Lingard come back. I think, you know, I sort of feel sorry for him. I don't know the advice he was given or what he's done at United, but to have the minutes he has and see his career going where it is from where it was in the summer on the fringe of an England squad with a World Cup coming up and all that good stuff, I think he'd be... A move would do both of us a lot of good. And as I said, a striker, a left-back and a centre-back as well from somewhere would be fantastic. I know. Whoever's in charge of scouting is going to earn his money this January.
Yeah, and we shall see. We shall see what West Ham are able to do. But in the meantime, it is a trip to Palace. But it's up, man. Andy, thanks a lot for coming on. Appreciate your time.
No problem, mate. Speak to you soon.
Okay, we're back after we had Andy and Bradley. Very kind of them both, and John as well. Of the games that look as though they're still going ahead, Southampton face Newcastle and Leeds versus Burnley looks like it probably will happen as well. Leeds, we'll do Leeds-Burnley first, Mo. It's a proper six-pointer. Mm-hmm. It's an absolute six-pointer. The decimated Leeds, no matter what, or no Calvin Phillips till March. There's a lot of talk about them going into the market, but part of the reason why people think that Calvin Phillips is a £60 million player is that there's not that many of them knocking around the place. Burnley are actually okay against United on the whole over the course of the 90 minutes. A win puts Burnley two behind with two in hand. And if you're Burnley at the minute, you're thinking, we've got to finish ahead of Newcastle, we've got to finish ahead of Norwich, we've got to find one more. And I suspect Sean Dyche will have them absolutely like rabid dogs before that game on Sunday.
Well, the thing that Burnley have over Leeds is that they've got a relegation plan. Like, Sean Dyche knows exactly what he needs to hit, at what point knows which games he needs to target and why. So they will be absolutely have been targeting this game for a long time. And you're right. I think the thing with the United game is that it allows them to knock off a bit of the rust that they undoubtedly would have had.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know some of the players who they had missing, Nick Pope, Sue Rodriguez, I don't know if either of them will be back for this game. But if they are, obviously they get stronger again.
But you also, the other thing you feel about them though, Mo, is they will have an attitude of, you know, they finished the game. They arguably have as good a second half as Man United. The underlying numbers suggest that as well. They are 3-1 down before the break, but from that point in the game, you know, there's three more chances of significance. Mm-hmm. One goes to United, two go to Burnley. I think they'll be feeling like, yeah, if we can go and do that at Man United, we can go and do that at Leeds United.
Yeah, and again, the way the Leeds play is so I mean, everyone's game plan against them is the same, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's that you just need to be able to beat your man when they play such a man-to-man system, and then he creates gaps, and then chaos ensues from there. So they'll have been working on it. They'll have been drilled within an inch of their lives. And then on top of that, you have set pieces.
So the other thing they did that was that interesting against United, which I think they solely did because they were going to play Leeds next. They flipped the wingers.
Oh, really?
So they got the wingers to come inside. So Goodmanson played off the left and McNeil played off the right. And I think they solely did that. When I saw, I only watched a little bit of the game, if I'm honest, but when I was watching it, I was thinking they're only doing that. So when they play against Leeds, they've just got these lads constantly coming inside, filling the middle once they beat their man.
Yeah.
It really was as though, it was as though Dice treated it like a pre-season friendly.
And that shows you how important this game is. And Bielsa, he won't, well, I mean, he'll obviously have a plan for Burnley. He'll know exactly everything about what Burnley do, and he'll think he'll have a way of beating them. What he won't be doing is he won't be saying to his team, okay, they're playing like this now, so we need to beat them now. No, what he'll be saying is that this game is just the same game as every other game, and he'll be trying to kind of minimise the six-pointness of it. I think if you're Leeds, I think if you're the kind of team who thrives potentially, is that Allen Road?
Is that Allen Road?
Yeah. If you're the kind of team who thrives off that crowd, and they are, I think you need to go the opposite way. I think you need to make it as big as possible.
It's one of those where you hope, well, if you're a Leeds fan, you can hope the translator goes, yeah, no, I'll tell him that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right, lads, fuck it out. This is, he's just told me this is the biggest game of your life. I think it's one of those games where Leeds have to possibly rely on the fact they've got some quality in players like Rafinha, who are as good as some of those players they faced last night in other ways. And they just got to think, we can beat Burnley, and Burnley's seen that one of those teams, quite impressively, that are kind of unaffected by the result. It's they just go again. They're just the same thing. Don't worry. They're probably not that happy when they win, not that sad when they lose. And I think Leeds either try and get in their heads and take it down to the trenches, or just think, well, we've got better players. We've got things we can offer. We can do. Stuart Dallas was quite important for this game because he's just such a like Swiss Army knife footballer, isn't he?
Yeah.
And I think the only thing I wonder with Burnley is, can you contain Burnley? Probably. So you just need to make the most of what they'll give you, which they will give you some bits and bobs. I'm hoping that, because the other thing about the games like this is, you look at the actual average points. You can't assume Burnley going to win those two games. They can't pick up points. So
no.
It's one of those where it also you have to not let it feel almost ironically to where I started. Not let it feel too important, because if they're averaging 1 point a game or whatever, then those two games in hand aren't going to change everything. They've got to go above their station, but yeah, who knows really.
My concern for Leeds is I'll face it the other way. The thing with Burnley and Dice is they operate in their own kind of universe. It's very Allardyce, if you will. Allardyce plus two, where, as you said there, if they get beat, they're not really arsed. They know at some point they'll pick up a win. It's like the Hodgson point average that Neil coined years ago. They're not really affected one way or the other. They won't change the way they do things drastically. Like more the methodology, you know, you're talking about the switching the wingers and that, but you know what Burnley are going to do. I like Leeds, I like Bielsa, but we've seen this before with him when he's run teams into the ground, and this is it's terminal because he's such a godhead, because everything is kind of weighted on him. When he starts to fail, or more when, I think Brendan Rodgers got a little bit of this in him despite the result the other day. Unless he has 100,000% conviction of every member of that playing squad, as soon as he starts thinking, well, this isn't working anymore.
And is it me?
And I is think, it me?
Yeah.
Or is it him?
Yeah.
It's a lot harder to pull that back. Now, I could be wrong, and I hope I am wrong, because I think Bielsa is a fantastic manager. I think he's, you know, he's a brave manager as well. But if you'd ask me, out of the two, who's more like, if one of them was to go down, I think they'll both survive. But if you're going to say to me which one of the two will survive, if one of them got to go down, I would put money on Burnley before I put money on Leeds.
That is indeed how that one will go. The other one that's interesting, Southampton versus Newcastle, Chris. Southampton appear to either overperform or underperform in every game, which is mad and it shouldn't be possible, but there we are. Newcastle look like a football team against Man United, but they are now decimated. I've got a sneaking fancy this might not happen. Of all of them on the horizon, you know, Newcastle, I think, between injuries and COVID cases, do look like they're in a spot of bother. If it does happen, though, and Newcastle are, whatever you are, one step above decimated and able to play the game, you are if Southampton win, they are suddenly 13.
Southampton, Newcastle off. Just literally just being
fucking great. Move on. Brentford Villa.
I was just about to predict that as well. So.
Brentford Villa.
Literally, there you go.
Brentford versus Villa. Doing this show at the minute, it is fraught with danger. Brentford versus Villa. Brentford just needs a Hodgson the rest of the season. And but this one feels to me, Chris, like a winnable home.
Before I breathe in, is it on? I was just about to talk about Ward-Prowse for a while there, but now
well, you know what, right? Actually, we might. It might be worth chatting shit for a minute because it's 1 p.m. and they generally have some inner raft.
Oh, right.
But I thought to chat shit for a while, I did think that Villa against Chelsea was quite a strange performance. I think they'd have been quite annoyed at themselves.
Yeah.
At home as well, in this sort of like, it's fun. Football at home is fun at this time of season. Well, if you're not at Stamford Bridge, for fuck's sake. But I think Brentford against City played well. I thought they actually, there's something about this the current top flight of English football where there's so many dynamic teams. There's so few Burnleys now. And you look up and down the league, and even Norwich, who are dog shit, are trying to be a bit different with what they do and a bit clever. And I think that Brentford and Villa could be one of those games that it's actually got quite a nice bit of quality and quite a nice two teams that are actually both happy with and without the ball. And both have some players who are, in that echelon of like, if they were available, other clubs would be popping in for them. And like, you could see him. Someone like Ivan Toney is immense. He's such a good player. And then you've got John McGinn on the other dressing room. But yeah, I think it's two quite modern teams doing modern things.
The assumption is the Brentford game's going to happen.
Brentford's going to happen.
No, it's touch wood.
It's a big one for Brentford. I think in that ultimately, if you're looking at Brentford now, you sit where you are in the table. You are looking at your remaining homes. You face City, you faced Chelsea, you faced Liverpool, you faced Arsenal. That is the current top four. All have come to your gaff. That's done. So if you are right now Thomas Frank, you're sitting there thinking, right, home games remaining. If we win half of them and get a draw and another couple, we are safe.
Yeah, I think so. And it's a very interesting situation as to how the manager deals with it, because at the moment they aren't scoring enough goals. That's their biggest problem. It's all like one goal or not enough goals. But if you look at, for example, the Brighton game, they had more shots on target than Brighton. They had more shots than Brighton. So they're still getting into position. They're still creating the chances. Their football is still working. It just means that they need to be a little bit more precise. Now, again, that can happen to you at any point in the season. But I think you're right. I think they're able to say, okay, we only have to think about a certain number of games here. And if we can capitalise on them the same way Leeds and Burnley were, we'll be fine. The flip side about Villa I find quite interesting is that obviously Steve is still in this kind of honeymoon period, but they are win-loss, 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 win-loss at the moment. Yeah. And yes, those losses were against Chelsea, Liverpool, Man City. So they were mitigating circumstances. But after a while, once you've played six games, you need to be settled in. You need to be able to say, look, lads, we will go on a run of form. And after this game, we've got two games with Man United and one against Everton. And the thing with those three games is no one's going to be talking about Aston Villa's footballers during those games. Everybody's going to be talking about Steven Gerrard. So they need to be able to go into these games thinking, okay, all of that circus is not going to distract us from what we need to do. We need to be able to put runs together. So I'd be very interested to see the outcome of this game.
Okay, other one, because we're going to circle back into Liverpool given what's come through the press conference, which you'll already know as you're listening to this. Is there a way for Everton to just simply continue not to play games? I think it will make everybody happy and they could just stay up via Pool's panel verdict.
I'd love it this season to end on the roll of a dice.
But
imagine what Sky Sports would do with that. Imagine if they televised that. Do you want to be chairman or managers or,
you know,
or
what?
Captain?
You know what, right? Tyler will still show more enthusiasm than he does when he does a fucking Liverpool game, dickhead. Sorry.
It would also offer the... I like the idea, though, that ultimately you're like...
I love how much you lot hate Tyler. It makes me laugh so much.
Blues would be livid with Benitez's dice throwing technique. You know what I mean? If it came to that, they would be...
Would he be defensive with his... I'd love to see it.
It's too indecisive.
Yeah.
Hang on a minute, you're all forgetting, and you should know this. I'm a bit disappointed that he was the university champion of strategy.
He was indeed. Benitez would back himself in any scenario, but he'd back himself at dice with no shadow.
Or like a big game like British Bulldog. Just something to sort of end it differently. I think it'd be clear.
I just think there'd be something philosophically so wonderful for Everton just to continue not to play.
So
that they'd all be quite cheery about it. They'd all be quite upbeat.
See, the only issue with this is that vacuum may well be filled with transfer transfer rumours. And at the moment, if you're an Everton fan, the idea of giving Luka Dean to Chelsea in return for Ross Barkley kind of feels like the worst thing that could possibly happen in the world right now.
Do you reckon?
I think they think that.
I don't know if it's true or not.
They always think that.
They do always think that.
That's a screensaver mindset for them, isn't it?
All right then. So what's come through out of this, out of the manager's press conference, Liverpool manager, is that there will be three players with COVID cases. There'll be no Thiago and no Minamino for the game on Sunday with injury. Thiago has a hip injury. Three COVID cases in the team. It's not so cool at the moment, says the manager. Postponement, not yet, but we've never had this outbreak. It's more like every day another one, a few staff. It feels like a lottery. We have to wait. The boys are not even in yet. We don't know how it'll look in a few hours. This is the key thing here, Mo. He says, the other thing he says is you'll know who's out when you see the team. And Alisson didn't train. He wasn't in any of the pictures yesterday. You feel, Andy, as though that could well be one of them. It's the most obvious you'll know who's out when you see the team if the keeper's not there.
Well, yeah. I mean, is Akterbeg fit?
On a serious point,
if it is Alisson, the big risk, because of the way Liverpool train and the keepers all train in a tight unit, you presume that if Ali's got it, if he, one of the others hasn't tested positive now, the chances of another one, if it is Alisson.
Who's your outfield keeper if you have to?
Milner.
Yeah, easy.
See,
a stupid question.
I mean, in terms,
he trains with them anyway.
See, I've got a different theory on this. I would have Matip, and I think not just for the clearance in terms of he'll actually cover more of the goal. I think in terms of those one-on-ones, he's more of a, he's not going to panic. He knows what to. He's watched Alisson. He knows
and
what to
do. You know, on FIFA, when you roll it out to yourself, he'd be great at that.
Milner is actually very good in goal for a managed side. But he played. We've been told that a couple of times. Also, he was very, very good at cricket, and he's a wicket keeper when he's playing cricket as well.
I got told once he sleeps with his eyes open, which I'd love to. And that's not. I got told that by someone who met him when they were little on a holiday. And they sort of kept in touch with his parents, and that's what she always said to me. And if I look at him, I think, wow, must have
amazing.
Dry eyes, though. Good, makes him good at football.
I also, one of the ones, Firmino missed training yesterday as well, but I actually would think Firmino would be quite good in goal in a way, in terms of the fact that he's very, very, very.
Back to the series, 42, Alisson's massive.
Yeah.
If he's not there. I mean, that changes so much about the thinking of the lineup, so. You know, that'd be the biggest worry. And then we see where we are. And then you presume if it is, and he's not also picked anything up, Kelleher will play, which normally wouldn't bother me. I just think you need that assurance and stuff.
It's what it does to both dressing rooms, isn't it? Those sort of big injuries, those big moments. That's why it's probably why someone like Ronaldo plays the 98 World Cup final, because it's too big a miss on that team sheet. It does too much to both.
I think it's a difficult one, because on the one hand, when you're in a game like this and any big moment could be decisive, you want to have your best of the best. I don't think that it was the situation where, you know, sometimes when there's a replacement in and the team changes because of them. So, for example, when Adrian plays, everyone changes how they play slightly. I don't know whether I'm being optimistic here. I feel like that happens less with Kelleher. I feel like they trust him to do the things more. But I just think you're right. In those key moments, it might end up being
critical. I think they trust him to do all. Well, I think that they'd be right to trust him to do all the bits of playing football apart from making saves. And that's a bit of a problem.
Yeah, it's kind of like the most important. It's like, the top
or
of
more
list.
Actually making 8 out of 10 saves, if you see what I mean. Like, so I think that, you know,
it's the Lukaku 1v1, isn't it?
It's the Lukaku 1v1. It's the moment when, you know, it's the Maddison effort.
It's the mount from distance. I was going to ask. Yeah. So the one that jumped out to me was someone just thinking, well, let's keep something. Yeah. Because Chelsea have got a problem with getting the ball into the box in a sort of cohesive way. So if their mindset is have a few pops from distance, then, you know, even players like Kante and Kovacic have got quite a good shot on them. And you think that would be a moment where you the dynamic of the game changes for both play for both teams to sort of almost so much that it becomes a different game.
More likely to save a penalty though.
He is more likely to save a penalty. Part of this is there's.
When we get penalties. I hate the way he takes them. It's so cool and so fucking badass.
It's one of my. You know what?
But I hate why I make it hard. Just what you don't. Penalties are literally a doozy. You don't need to worry about the keeper.
But he's missed one.
I know.
Against us. And for the life of me, I can't get my head around.
Well, no, Pickford saved him as well, didn't he?
Yeah, he has missed.
Just stand. I understand the burning desire
get
for
in
a
his
keeper.
Head again. Yeah.
To resist the temptation to move, because if you stand stock still, and it rolls it in the corner, you look like an idiot. But you know what's even worse?
When he sits you down.
When he sits you down.
The worst one is, though, he got two against Martinez, who I'd have said is a penalty psychopath.
But look where they go in. Look where they go in.
Yeah.
But sometimes they hit the corners, but more often than not,
yeah,
they're within four yeah yards of the inside of the post. Now, are you telling me from 12 yards, a keeper who backs himself?
But that's what, yeah, that's why I'm at the stage. I hate, I'd rather not get a pen.
And they're very rarely up high.
No.
It's the fucking calling the hand the great savable height.
Yeah, yeah. But the only thing he has in his locker, though, is sometimes he just does a different pen. I often wonder if they know that if they don't move, he'll just hit it low and hard and high.
No, but once he slows up, he can't then suddenly go like that, can't he? Can't
maybe
suddenly
not,
then blank.
No, I don't know.
Because you're off balance.
But he's a lot harder, yeah. But when he did two against Martinez, I thought, oh, he must actually have a massive brass pair of bollocks, because Martinez is like, I'm scared of him through the TV on a penalty.
I mean, there is a theory where you can't hypothesise there. You know the way you can't come off your line, but you can start behind your line?
Yeah, yeah.
Start behind your line and give yourself that extra yard.
Start leaning on the goal.
No, but you can come forward. If you're behind, you can come forwards.
Yeah, 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 you can.
So can you like swing on the
That's what Tim Crawl does.
If you swing in, you'll make sure you hit.
Tim Crawl against Chelsea, the Mount took two of the worst penalties ever. He just got it a bit wrong. He started way behind the line. He knew he could get in Mount's head, and he knew he wasn't the taker. And Tim Crawl's a good penalty.
But you can also get more forward men.
Yeah, yeah.
So if someone's going to ping it high in the corners, you're best staying on your line and starting there. But if someone's going to do that little staggered thing,
yeah, exactly.
I'm probably wrong. It's just a theory.
Well, you could. If you want to get in someone's head, imagine you stagger your step up to the line as he staggers his own. You really wanted to do a number on someone. If you just went, oh, go on, you're doing that. You can do that. Watch this.
I've always wondered why last minute pens are keeping and like take his gloves off.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, do something and be like, yeah, I'm not bothered.
Yeah.
Like, but I remember Bartosz used to like kick both posts for about a full 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Really spent ages. Yeah. I'd love it if pens were more.
Or if keepers started going, put it there. Go
yeah, yeah.
I'm going this side because you're used to put it there.
Do you remember Joe Hart was good against Lampard?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what was that? 8-9 years ago. He was like, don't wait for me. And he saved it. But Lampard was good at pens. And I remember it was away at City. And he just kept screaming, don't wait for me. And then he obviously saved it. And I think keepers should be weirder. Mark Clattenburg tongue.
I think Adrian would have a couple of things like that up his sleeve. Because remember, he threw his gloves when he scored against Everton.
Yeah.
Before he even took it.
Before he took his penny, so his gloves off. Which is, it's a remarkable. Ricardo did the same thing for Portugal against England.
Yeah, yeah,
it's a remarkably cool move.
Yeah.
I'm taking these off. I'm not going to need them again. It's sorted.
Yeah, I'm done.
Excellent. All right then, that's been your Friday show. Fuck knows if the Liverpool game's going to go ahead. We talked about it for long enough to make me suggest it might not do. Thanks to Mo, thanks to Chris, thanks to Andy, thanks to John, Bradley, and Andy as well. Have a lovely weekend. Liverpool may well play. Sports Social Podcast Network.